Louise LeBeau College of Business. She also serves as the Executive Director of the Institute for Strategic Leadership. And she also serves, these are long bios, I'm just trying to just give you the highlights here, but she also serves as an on-air political analyst for CBS News. And very recently, which I thought was very interesting, she was selected as one of 8 US leaders on the Eisenhower Fellowship, where she spent a month in China studying the underrepresentation of women in the governments of the G20 countries. Right. Pretty impressive. So welcome. So before we get started, I really just wanted to share with you all an exchange that I had with my husband that quite frankly changed. Carla. I'm so sorry.
You know what my name is Carla Harris, just so you know.
You know what it is? We did a panel this morning, and I'm just so familiar with her. I'm like, hey, it's Carla. What's the big deal? So, Carla Harris, everybody. She's the Vice Chairman of Wealth Management, Managing Director, and Senior Client Advisor at Morgan Stanley. She was appointed by President Barack Obama to chair the National Women's Business Council. And she's received so many awards that they're too many to mention. But she also sits on the board, or past chair, on the board of the Morgan Stanley Foundation. And she's a singer. I don't know how many of you know that, but she has 3 albums. Wow. And in addition to that, just in her spare time, she's actually written 2 books. She's the author of Strategize to Win and Expect to Win. So please, welcome Carla Harris. So my sincere apologies. So as I was saying, before we start, I'd like to share an exchange with you all that I had with my husband, which changed my PhD and my entire view of women in the workplace. You see, we all seem to be pretty fascinated with women in the workplace. We have countless books, talks, training programs, and solutions for how we advance women. In fact, I'm so passionate about this topic, I've dedicated my entire research to it, which is 4 years. And anyway, one day, I'm sitting in my office, and now my office is lined with books, just books, ceiling to floor, on this topic. I've got journal articles, you name it. And I'm sitting in there working away, and my husband walks in, and he starts staring at this wall of books. And I thought, this is gonna be interesting. And he turns to me and he's shaking his head and he says, what's with all the books? Now, I don't think he knew how much money I'd spend on books, but you know, that he sort of looked at it. And then he said, why do women need all these books? What's wrong with them? Why do they need to be fixed? I mean, guys don't need these books. So I took a deep breath and I tried to remain calm. I tried to listen to what this white privileged male was saying before me. And he is a self-proclaimed feminist, by the way, but he didn't really have much choice. So I turned to him and I said, before I start my rant, let's get one thing clear. Women do not need to be fixed. In fact, in many regards, women have all the skills that they need to succeed. Studies have shown that women are wired to think and act in innovative ways. We're more inclusive, we're more collaborative, we're better suited to the changing world of work. We have greater social sensitivity, we can better handle social uncertainty. We're perceived as more supportive, more rewarding, more persuasive. We have a more inclusive leadership style, we foster stronger team cohesiveness. We're more collaborative, we take more initiative, we practice stronger self-development. And most importantly, we demonstrate integrity and honesty when driving results. So what's with all the books? Well, my answer to this is that workplaces are not a meritocracy. If they were, women would rule. You see, most women in organizations work in organizations that have been created, designed, managed, and led by men and for men. This makes it particularly difficult for women to succeed, because they are gendered invisible barriers that prevent women from advancing, and more importantly, from thriving at work. Let me give you an example. So in organizations, we have gendered stereotypes about what it means to be a leader. Research finds that if you think of a strong leader, you invariably think of people who are decisive, aggressive, assertive. And guess what? Those are attributes you generally associate with men. Men better fit the mold of what it means to be a leader in today's organizations. And this is not surprising, really, given that they've been managing these organizations for a very long time. Women who do not fit this ideal image of the masculine leader are often perceived as less competent or somehow lacking the required leadership attributes. It's no surprise that women struggle with confidence at work. Even when women do demonstrate these masculine leadership characteristics, they're penalized for it. They're seen as difficult or perceived as needy. They are challenging the established standards for how women should behave. This is the gender stereotype. This is the invisible barrier. And guess what? This is further compounded by any other area of difference, be it race, age, disability, or sexual orientation. Research finds that this gender stereotype creates a confidence gap for women who constantly have to prove their worth because they're held to a higher standard of performance. It is an impossible standard. Despite the fact that women have the education, skills, competencies, leadership attributes to succeed, they are made to feel as though they are constantly lacking. So in response to this, women feel like imposters. We compensate. We overly focus on the what of work. I know this from personal experience. We focus on achieving outputs, qualifications, technical skills, exceeding performance standards, because we constantly have to prove our right just to participate at work, let alone lead. Often, this is to the detriment of managing the how of work. This is your social environment. This environment, as we now all know, is tougher for women because we face gendered, invisible barriers. Even if your motivation, even if you're sitting here today saying, Michelle, look, that's very nice, but my motivation is not to climb some corporate ladder. Even if your motivation is more about thriving at work and just enjoying your job, this is largely determined by your effectiveness to manage your social environment at work. To thrive, to be engaged in your work, to learn, to grow professionally, is dependent on your ability to manage social relationships at work. Thriving is really about understanding your social environment, understanding relationships, managing perceptions, and most importantly, doing this in an authentic way. This is what it means to have political skill. There's a ton of research out there that shows that political skill enhances career progression, performance, task performance, stress management, and relationships in general. These are the skills that are needed to succeed in the changing world of work, where creativity and innovation are reliant on collaboration, diversity of thought, and inclusive leadership. They're also the skills that are needed for any type of organization, be it hierarchical or flat organizations. It's equally important to manage your networks and to access those by using political skill. Despite the importance of the topic, not everybody loves it. There's common disdain, and we talked about this earlier, for the term office politics or being political at work. People often see this as manipulative or sneaky. But this view often assumes that workplaces are a meritocracy, that what you're judged on is simply your output. It's missing the real work of work, which is managing relationships. The world of work has changed. Political skill is now the currency for how you manage relationships at work. It's just like any other competency. When used in excess, it can result in negative outcomes. Not everybody hates it, though. Research shows that men are actually more involved in the use of informal influence tactics than women. When it comes to office politics, men are more likely to accept and engage in it to their benefit. Women's lack of willingness to engage in it is largely because these behaviors don't feel like our own. In fact, research shows that women see these behaviors as masculine. And this is true. We're held to a different standard. The invisible barriers tell us this. Women have a different set of rules. Interestingly, while those standards may be different, the same skills are needed to navigate these rules. Research has demonstrated that women can cope with office politics by engaging with it, rather than resisting. Women who fully engage in office politics, the ones who display high levels of political skill, have actually been found to manage to break the glass ceiling. Women can excel in male-led workplaces precisely because they rely on the political skills they already have to navigate the impossible standards for women. The goal of our panel today is certainly not to fix women. You all already have the skills you need to succeed. Rather, our goal is to unveil the invisible barriers to women's success and share strategies for how women can use the skills they already have to navigate these invisible barriers. And there are no better women to do it today than these three lovely ladies here. So we have a number of questions that we're going to run through in a Q&A format, And then we're going to open it up to the audience in about half an hour. So join us. All right.
Welcome.
Great introduction.
Thank you. So we might get started, Cara, I'm so sorry, with your book, Strategize to Win. You write about performance currency versus relationship currency. Can you share a bit about what that is and, and why it's important?
Sure. So performance currency is the currency that is generated by what you deliver and doing it above expectations. So every time you deliver on an assignment above where people expect it, you generate performance currency. And it works just like the stock market. Anytime a company says to the street that they will deliver 25 cents a share in a quarter, and that company delivers 40 cents a share, that stock goes up, and so will yours. Early on in your career, performance currency is worth about $1.50. And it is valuable for three reasons. Number one, early on in your career or early on in any environment, it will get you noticed. It will create a reputation for you. Everybody knows that you're good. The second thing is that it will also get you paid and promoted very early on in your career and early on in any new environment. And number three, it will raise your level of visibility such that a sponsor, which is the most critical relationship in your career, that's the person that's using their political and social capital on your behalf behind closed doors, that performance currency raises your level of visibility such that a sponsor may be attracted to you. Or it doesn't always happen that way for many of us, so we have to sometimes ask for a sponsor. And if you have good performance currency and you ask someone to be your sponsor, it heightens the probability that they may answer in the affirmative on your behalf. But here's the problem with performance currency. Over time, that $1.50 worked its way right back down to a dollar. Why? Because now you have created a new standard of excellence. Everybody knows that you will do a great job. Everybody expects that you will always deliver. So there's no longer any premium associated with your deliverable. The currency that now becomes most important is the relationship currency. And relationship currency is worth about $2.25. And it never experiences any diminishing marginal returns. And relationship currency is the currency that is generated by the investments that you make in the people in your environment. The investments that you make in the people in your environment. None of us work in a silo anymore. We're all working in highly interdependent environments. So at a minimum, you must have a relationship with every seat that touches your seat. If the only person that knows that you're doing a great job is your boss, then your ability to ascend is going to be vulnerable. Why? That person may leave the organization. They may lose their seat at the decision-making table, or they may lose their juice. So it's your job to make sure as many people as possible is aware of your outsized contribution. So often I hear people say, oh, I'm not going to engage in those politics. I'm not going to worry about building all those relationships. I'm going to keep my head down. I'm going to do my work. I'm going to let my work speak for me. But guess what? The work does not speak. You must put your work in context through the relationships that you have. And here's two last points that I'm going to make about relationship currency. Your ability to ascend will be a function of somebody's judgment. Judgment about whether or not you're ready, judgment about whether or not the team will follow you, and judgment about whether or not you will ultimately be successful. And ladies and gentlemen, judgments are directly influenced by relationships. My last point, everybody in this room has power, hard-earned personal influential currency. But as I asked you this morning, how many people in this room will use their hard-earned personal influential currency on someone that they do not know? No one. So remember that your inability to move up in an organization or even to move around in an organization will rarely, if ever, be a function of whether or not somebody likes you, but it will absolutely be a function of whether or not somebody knows you. When your name is called behind closed doors, where, by the way, all of the important decisions about your career will be made, when your name is called, if nobody in that room can speak on your behalf, they just go to the next name on the list. And it has nothing to do with your ability to do the job, but everything to do with whether or not somebody in that room knows who you are.
Mm. Yeah. very powerful words. I like that idea of relationship currency. We talked before about maybe rebranding political skill relationship currency, and I think it really hits home the importance of that. So, Alison, I think given your experience in politics, maybe you're suited to this topic, particularly this next question. You know, politics is often associated with not being open or transparent, right? And given your experience in the field, you know, how did you build your own social awareness or understanding of politics and how it's played?
Sure. So, can everyone hear me? No? Sorry. Now is that better? Okay. So, thank you. I appreciate the question, Michelle. So, before I came to Philadelphia about 7 years ago, I spent 15 years in D.C. Do we have any D.C. folks in here? Yeah. All right, a few. So, relationship currency is the currency in D.C., and I am grateful. It wasn't purposeful. It was, I think, purely by accident, me learning about my own social awareness over the early part of my career, that I got really good at the relationship currency. And I wanted to share with you a story about how I got there and what that meant for me. When I'm a small town girl, okay? I grew up in Western New York. I came from a place where we get the first day of deer season off of school. Like, that's true story, okay? And at 31 years of age, I am being called to the West Wing to meet with the chief of staff at the time was an amazing, amazing, amazing American named Josh Bolton. And the chief said to me, and we'd never met, it's 9 o'clock at night, small town girl from Mayville, New York, is standing at the gates of the West Wing to be let in for what was my interview, where I was asked one question. 9 o'clock at night with these amazing people. Have you ever done anything to embarrass the president? I've embarrassed myself many times, but no, sir, no. But that was the extent of the interview, because what they needed to know about me before I walked in that room, they had already known. Mm-hmm. I was 31 at the time, and I was appointed as a special assistant to the President of the United States. I wasn't the person in line, and this answers your question about social awareness and relationship currency. The person that was really in line by age, by title, for the job is one of my dearest friends and mentors to this day, who will be the first person to tell you that he is a bull in a china shop. Excellent at his job all the time. Excellent. A great mentor, but not very well liked. And so when it came time for the president to choose the next person to take on the role that I did, which was overseeing the president's call to service. How are you serving your neighbor? Calling on all Americans to give 2,000 hours of service over their lifetime in service to your neighbor. When it came time to find that person, they came to me, and not to this person who I refer to as a mentor and friend, because I had spent time. And that's my own kind of journey of social awareness and authenticity. I spent my time in D.C. getting to know people, investing in the things that, not financially investing, for all those of you that work in government, you know you're not financially investing in anything. You know, you're working for a pittance for all those years. That's not what it's about. It's about public service. But I spent my time with the people that could be influential in my life, the people that were working on things that I cared about, that I felt that I had something to contribute to. And that investment of time built me relationships in the right place that Alison Young from Mayville, New York, is standing in the West Wing at the age of 31 when I thought all along I'd probably get there by the time I was 55. So that's my own story of social currency. Now, I have to tell you one other thing that my very dear, 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 amazing husband is here in the audience today. And as Carla's sitting here talking about how you have to be your own advocate, he's sitting there going, see, I told you. Because I've made mistakes too. And when I got to Philadelphia, this is what happened to me. I had achieved all these wonderful things in D.C. I had people that believed in my merit. I had built strong relationships. And I came to a new city. And for those of you that are all, you know, all of you from Pennsylvania, you know that this is a town where you have to raise your hand. And I didn't do it. So I had learned this lesson. I came here and I made years of mistakes because I thought, you'll just come and find me. Yeah, you must know. I'm Alison Young, special assistant to the president. How many of you could care, right? So I, even knowing it and being aware of it, I still make the mistakes. So don't beat yourself up over it. You'll still make the mistakes, but that time and that knowing that people have a currency for time, that they care about the time you invest in those relationships, has really been a huge part of my career advancement.
Yeah, no, that's critical, absolutely critical. Mm-hmm. So Anna, What do you think are some of the most significant challenges to women's advancement in organizations today?
I think the most significant challenge that women face in a way that men don't is that we're subject to sucker's choice. And sucker's choice is when you feel like you have to choose between either or, and they're both terrible options. And so tangible ways women have to deal with this is in two ways. One, you kind of addressed, you know, in likability, right? Your women are taught to think you're either likable or you're a badass boss. You can't be both. You know, and that is a very difficult challenge to overcome, because when you exert confidence, when you are aggressive, assertive, when you speak up, at best you may be labeled bossy. At worst, women have certainly been called way worse than that, right? And then the second sucker's choice that women face, especially when they choose to have family and children, is that we are all taught that we have to choose between, again, having a badass career or being a great mother, and that you somehow can't mix the two. And there are very few role models, whether it's in pop culture, in movies, or in real life. And so and I think this limits our ability to really think of ourselves in a way where we are authentic to our ambitions. And Pew Research backs that up. Millennial women today, they have just as much desire for leadership, but they don't think they can do it, because they know that somewhere along the way, they have to face this sucker's choice.
May I just add to that? I think I blame my generation of leaders for not passing along enough of the stories, because I am cringing as we speak at the number of young women that I hear asking the question that was being asked 30 years ago when I was at Harvard Business School. Ooh, can I have it all? Don't I have to make these trade-offs? And I am scratching my head saying, why are these young women asking that question? It's been 30 years. So yes. My conclusion is that we fail to pass on the truths that you absolutely can have it all. The issue is you need to define what all looks like for you and not evaluate your life against somebody else's report card.
Right. And I think the thing that we haven't taught young women to do, or we haven't taught each other to do, is reframe the question of sucker's choice. It's not about either or. It's about solving for the and. And when you're starting to solving for the and, then you start thinking, okay, well, I'm not going to have the pop, you know, culture sort of idea, romantic ideals of having it all. Mm. I'm going to create the life that has the and for me, where I can be a great mother and have a great career, where I can be a badass boss and be a caring person, that they can coexist and find my own solutions to that end. And it's a mindset thing, right?
It is a mindset thing. I think it's a really important part of this whole piece, is understanding, you know, what you're really fighting for and why you're engaging and why you're building those relationships. The why, it's no good to just build currency and then not use it. You know, research tells us women do that as well. So we build a lot of amazing currency, but we never check it in or cash it in. So I've got a question for you then, Carla. In terms of political skill or, you know, relationship currency, in your mind, why is that so critical?
Yeah, it's critical, as I said before, because your ability to move up, especially in senior levels, will not be a function of just the performance. When you get to a certain level in your career or in your organization, there is an assumption of equity at that level, meaning at that level, those who are making the decision say, oh, they're all about the same. They all have about the same experience. They all have the same educational pedigree. They're all about the same. Now, you know as well as I do, there's lots of daylight between person A and person B, but they just lump everybody in together as you all are good. But what makes the difference, and the person that's going to get the nod, is the person that other people in the room feel like they can talk about. So that's why it's so important to connect, because if all you have when you enter that room, proverbially, I mean, when your name enters that room, if all you have is just the performance, it will not be enough, because people just will say everybody's about the same. So what has to happen is somebody has to be able to speak on your behalf to differentiate. And don't think that it takes that much of an investment in order to have that differentiation. With very light touches in your environment, people think that they know you. And if people think that they know you, you'll be surprised that folks will say, oh, yeah, she's a good gal. Now, what does that have to do with whether or not you can do the job? But she's a good gal. That's what they'll say. You know, and I remember when I first started in Wall Street, what I used to hear all the time is, oh yeah, he's a good guy, he's a good guy. And I used to think, what the heck is a good guy, right? And that's gonna be problematic for me because my plumbing is different. Now, wait a minute now, you know, so what is that? But it's that catch-all phrase that people say that means, oh yeah, that's a good person, let's give them the nod. And if they don't know you, they're never going to say that. That's why you need to invest. When you are putting your head down, working really hard, that will work early on in your career and very, very early on in a new environment if you are senior going into that new environment. But what's going to make the difference is who feels like they know you. Because think about it. When someone spends their currency on you, they want something back for that. They want a return on that currency. They want to know that you're going to do a good job. Nobody's going to give you the nod if they think you're not going to do a good job and you're not going to deliver. And the only way they can get comfortable with that is to know you in some way. So light touches will give you the ability to build that basis for that relationship.
Yeah, that's really, really important. I mean, we know the importance of the currency. So what are your views on, Anna, in terms of how we develop that currency?
So my approach has always been sort of politics from the inside out. I think people often think of politics as an external behavior. And I actually worked with an executive coach for quite a number of years. And my number one takeaway from that process is that personal power really starts from within. And so my approach to, you know, learning the political acumen skills has always been from inside out. So starting from really getting in touch with your mindset, with your motivations, with your gut, with, you know, having that social awareness. So I do a lot of journaling, I meditate. And the next level is, you know, exercising that growth mindset muscles. So it's, you know, thinking about what is the one person I should reach out to and have a relationship with that might make me a little uncomfortable? Mm-hmm. You know, what's a way to have a difficult conversation with a boss or with a peer that I'm uncomfortable with? And every day doing a little something that makes you a little uncomfortable. And then lastly, that's sort of the more public facing thing is really kind of think about, like, how do I show up in the world? What is my energy? What is my presence? And how can I be authentically engaging with those around me? But I think that if I don't do that internal work first and just work on the external behavior, that's when it can seem kind of sneaky and manipulative because it's not grounded in who I really am.
Wow, yeah. That's really powerful. Do you have anything to add, Allison or Carla, just on that topic of developing political acumen?
I needed to take the time. It didn't come to me naturally. When I left the White House, I had what I love to refer to as my midlife crisis, and I took 2 years just to travel. Everyone else that I was working with is cashing in these, you know, $500,000-$700,000 a year jobs, and I said to my family, I'm moving to Mexico. And it's a true story. And I thought that it was going to be 6 months, but it was 2 years of me actually finding out what drove me. I had been work. You know, when I graduated college, I started work the following Monday. Like, that was all I knew. And that was all this kind of external reinforcement. I was getting a lot of positive reinforcement for that. But now I'm 32, 33 years old at that point. I'm not going to tell you how old I am now, Carla. 40, as Carla would say. Yeah. And I had to carve out time to find out who I was and what that kind of internal barometer was for me. I think it's perfect advice. And I know that not everyone has the luxury of that time. I didn't have children at the time. I made that time in my life, and it was a sacrifice. It was a trade. But I had to figure out who I was. I think that's absolutely perfect advice.
And I'll say that if you know who you are, then I'm going to take a different tack on it in terms of what you need to do. And what I'll challenge you to do is to reframe this whole idea of playing politics, because those words have such a negative connotation for us because they tend to make us think about someone who is, you know, not sincere, somebody who's cutthroat, somebody who's nasty. So I'm gonna tell you to reframe that. Instead of thinking about playing the politics, I want you to think about how you are connecting relationships. And here's why. When I think of politics, I go, wait a minute, politics is just the word that describes how relationships interact. That's it. How do these relationships interact? That's what that thing is. And the example that I like to use, think about it when you were growing up. if you knew that your dad absolutely did not like something and he's told you no, no, no before, but you really wanted to do that, you went and asked your mother. That was a political decision. That was a political decision. You knew about this one, that relationship wasn't going to work, so you went to this relationship. So change the way you think about it and say, I need, in order to be successful in any environment, I will need relationships. So now let me figure out how I'm going to engage with those relationships in a way that feels good to me. And maybe you're not a golfer, maybe you don't like sports, but that person might have gone to the school that you went to, or that guy does have women in his life because he's married, or whatever, so you can always find something to connect with. And then if all else fails, remember that as humans, we all have something in common, and that's a need to be needed. So when you tap into somebody's need to be needed, you've tapped right into the thing that you share as humans. And it could be as simple as, I want to ask a question in the town hall. They're always asking for questions. So let me try this one on you. Tell me what you think. I'd like to get your thoughts. Is that a good one? Should I say it like that? You think I should be first? Should I be third? You're asking for that person's advice. And if you really want to create a connection, then you want to say to them, I heard you. So let me repeat what I think you said. You want me to ask the question this way. Or did I understand you to mean X? The person is now thinking, wow, she was listening. And guess what, ladies and gentlemen? Everybody values being heard. So when you said, I heard you, you just created some immediate value in that exchange. And from that value, you can continue to grow that relationship.
And I just want to follow up with one point on that, because you've given some great advice there on how to develop relationships. But the next sort of step in this, and we've touched on this earlier, is really leveraging those relationships. And, you know, using the currency, how do you cash in? So how do you do that?
Yes. And once you have the relationships, they are very, very valuable for you unless you don't use them, right? And in my business, you have to ask for the order. What's the point of having the relationship if at some point you don't leverage it and use it for something? So you should use those relationships to ask for the promotion, to ask for feedback. Why didn't I get that thing? Or to ask someone to help you with an introduction to someone else. That is the point. And if you are uncomfortable using those relationships, i.e., or using your network, then put yourself in somebody's way. Use your intellect and your influence on somebody else's behalf and watch how fast it will work for you. But you can't just sit on it. And so often I hear women saying, well, I don't want to ask them anything because I don't want them to think I want something. That's not the only reason that I had that relationship. Well, you do want something. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with that, because hopefully you will use your something on somebody else's behalf. That's the whole point of how these interactions are supposed to happen. And even though you may be sitting in the room today thinking you have no power, you do have power. You do have power. You know something or somebody that is valuable to somebody else. And once you start using it and doing that over and over, you will see how it will multiply and even amplify your own impact. But you must make the ask. That's the point of exercising your power. You can't control what's going to happen when you're not in the room, but you can control whether or not you make the ask. Mm. That's your power.
That's so important. I want to put a fine point on that, Carla. It's very well said. One of the mantras that I always carry with me is the best way to make a friend is to ask for a favor. People love to deliver for you.
Well said.
But how many of you are just afraid to ask, right? People love to deliver for you. Ask them something that they can deliver, but you know that's within, you know, something that they'll do on a daily basis, or make an introduction for you, or leverage one of those relationships. People love to make you happy. Don't be afraid to ask for a favor. In fact, it's a great way to make a friend. I can't tell you how many relationships I've built here in Philadelphia, in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, from people that I've gone to and said, you know what? I'm working on this, and I heard that you know XYZ. Oh, yeah, let me introduce you. Email, good? It happens. And then that's how you start those relationships.
I think you're showing your vulnerability, which is good. And then it also opens up the conversation for them to ask you a favor.
Yeah.
Then it really becomes a friendship.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So look, we are running tight on time. So we've got 15 minutes for Q&A. And I would just like to pause here. So Carla Harris has to leave. And I would just like to give her a very, very large round of applause. So thank her.
Thank you, Carla.
Thanks, Michelle.
No.
Sarah, you get a hug.
Are you kidding me? Thank you.
And so now what we'll do for the Q&A segment is feel free to line up at the microphones. We've got three, one, two, and three. And we'll just take it in turns if you've got any questions for our two panelists. We're down to two. So don't be shy. Feel free to line up at the mics.
You want to start over there, Michelle?
Yes, go ahead.
Yes. Good afternoon. And I want to thank you. I've enjoyed the panel. I really wanted Carla Harris to hear my question and hopefully weigh in on it. My question is, so what happens when you find your voice, you speak up at the table, the other folks do know you, you have the consummate degree, they know you work and they know you can deliver, and then they still don't support you? And I ask that because what I'm finding is that, not in all organizations, but in some organizations, white women don't support women of color. And I'm wondering what's going on with that, and that we're viewed as a threat, or because you do speak up, you support them, but when it comes to make the final decisions, they go with somebody that looks like them. And yet you have all the other things in place. And I wanted Carla to hear that too, because everybody says, oh, find your voice, find a mentor, do this, speak positively. Yeah. But what happens when you do all that and the sisters that don't look like me don't want us?
That is a powerful question. Thank you for that. Oh, we've got a hand here.
Yes, I'd love to take that. So I think about influence, I think speaking up and exercising the power of your voice is just step one. I think influence is 360 degrees. And so to have an effective influence campaign, whether that's to advocate for yourself or to advocate for a project that you're working on, there are actually three components to it. One is certainly articulating your point of view, showcasing, you know, raising your voice, speaking your truth. That's step one. Then the second thing is it helps when you have a third-party objective measure of some sort. If it's a project, that might be third-party research, third-party data. If it's your own performance, it might help to have something really objective. And then the third piece of that is having another advocate at the table speaking on your behalf, raising their voice on your behalf. And I think those are kind of, whether it's advocating for your own project or for, you know, yourself, those are kind of the three components to an effective influence campaign. And I'm also a woman of color, and I find that it does take all three for me to able to, you know, push through a project or advocate for myself. Just, you know, just my performance currency, or even just performance currency and relationship currency is not enough until I have all of those three pieces.
Thank you for that. Did you have anything to add to that, Alison? No. Okay. I might just pop over here.
So you're at a career choice, and you know you got to stay where you are. So I'm not necessarily looking to move up, but how can I reboot to get my voice back? Because I think it's just disappeared a little bit without stepping on the toes of the people that I'm still working with, because I'm not going anywhere anytime soon.
I want to thank. I appreciate the question, because I think what you're getting at, too, is not just where you are, but how everyone else is perceiving you in the room. Mm-hmm. So I'm also an emotional intelligence coach, and so I do this a lot with public servants because of my experience in government. And in so many cases in public service, people are subject matter experts but are bad at reading what else is going on in the room. So you're finding your voice. You come in and you say, this is the way it's going to be, and I know, and I'm an expert. And everyone else goes, oh, here we go again, right? And they can automatically tune you out. So there's two sides of this equation. It's you finding your voice and knowing where you want to be and trying to get yourself centered, but then also being able to read the kind of changing tides that are happening in the room. So go ahead. I'm sorry. You
so
want to ask
how
a
can you do that? Because that's actually the piece I think I have the hardest, right? I can find the voice. It's there. But how can I change those people to listen to me again?
Are you the one listening? Ask yourself if you're listening. If you're walking in the room all the time and getting ready, like you know what you're going to say, you're preparing it, you're thinking about it while others are talking, and you're not actually hearing or listening. For me, that has been, research shows that this is in the literature around emotional intelligence too, that your ability to listen and hear others impacts how they perceive you. People want to be heard. So are you walking into a room and listening before you say anything? You can have your say, you can have your voice, but are you listening to what others have to say, and is that kind of shifting what you're thinking? Are you interpreting that, or are you just ready to say what you were gonna say?
Thank you, that's very helpful.
Sure.
Excellent, thank you.
I was wondering if you can share some tips on figuring out how to regain currency that you've lost, if it's possible to do it, and how would you do that?
Can I tell you a story? this happened to me just recently. And I talk about this, I research about this, right? I work in academia now. We like to think about things, we like to discuss things, and we like to think about them some more, anyone here in higher ed? And I find it really frustrating. And so I find meetings very frustrating. I used to have 8-minute meetings, now we have some that are 2 hours. And so I would sit in these meetings and just, I decided I wasn't gonna contribute to the morass. I wasn't going to participate in the conversation. I was gonna wait, I was gonna read the room, I was gonna have my say, and then be done with it. But I wasn't just gonna participate in the dialogue. About an hour after this meeting happened, and I had my say, I said, you know, I presented what I knew, and about an hour after this meeting happened, my boss and I were chatting, and he goes, I gotta talk to you about something. The short version of the story was, I was like, yeah, wasn't that great? And he said, are you kidding? You had no idea what happened in that room. Because you didn't participate in the conversation, and in that conversation, the dialogue was the currency. And I completely misread it. I was instead sitting in my shell going, I'm gonna sit over here, not participate in all of that, and just tell you what I need to tell you. I completely misread the situation. And so now I've got, you know, 15 colleagues who are like, ugh, here's Allison again, right? So your question was true to me not long ago, because I had to go back and rebuild all that and make people feel like they were heard. Because I wasn't actually sitting in the meeting and tuning them all out. I was listening, I just didn't want to participate in the time suck. And so, but what they felt and what they heard was that I didn't listen and I didn't hear them. So for me, it meant one-on-one engagement with each and every one of them. Maybe not in a group meeting, but going to them and saying, hey, you remember when you were talking about this the other day? I totally got it, and here's where it's going to apply and what we're doing next week. I had to rebuild those relationships one-on-one. And I don't know if any of you have had that same situation, but when you're talking about rebuilding, I think it's face-to-face, one-on-one, not over email and not in a group.
But interestingly, in terms of the research on this, you actually require the same set of skills. So you require social awareness, you require interpersonal influence, your ability to influence it, you require your networks, you require authenticity. So you need to come across as authentic in your ability to try and reestablish the relationship. You maybe need to acknowledge what happened, so that's your social awareness, and then maybe work through some of the skills that you've got, right, around influencing. You've got those skills because you know that you messed up. That's how you know you've got those skills, right? So you can use those skills to try and patch it up. So that's why I say, I think starting from a strength base, that you actually have everything you need to succeed, is a really good way to go, because it's really using those skills you've already got. Okay, feel free.
Hello, ladies in the room.
Hi.
Hello.
Hello, panel. My name is Linda Fields. I live in Pennsylvania. And after the most recent election, I decided that instead of sitting on the sidelines and helping other people get elected, that I would decide to run for the Senate.
Woo-hoo.
Good for you.
And my question is very broad. My question is, will the women of Pennsylvania support a woman from Pennsylvania? Mm-hmm. A woman who is running against a man who has been in office for over 12 years and has never approached or even advocated for the rights of women. Mm. My question is, what type of support can I garner in this moment to get me to the Senate House so that the people's voice will be heard and not the opinions of men?
Ooh, that sounds
Which
like a
one
political
wants to take
question.
That, Allison,
Allison
sure.
Yes.
I applaud you for running. Thank you. Thank you for standing up and saying you're actually going to do something. So thank you for willing to step in and to be in service to the community. And I want to be really clear, too, that we have some great, yes, our state legislature is predominantly men. We have zero, they mentioned this at lunch today, we have zero women representing the Commonwealth in Congress, right? It's a travesty. But I want to be really clear that we're not just throwing all of our current state legislature out with the bathwater. Like, some of them are very, very, very good public servants. In fact, the majority of them are. And I think we need to start with a place of understanding that people are genuinely trying to do the best for the most. We can have political disagreements about whether or not they're doing the right thing. But for you, for resources, a couple of things. One of the things I've learned about Pennsylvania is that the state parties matter a lot here. Resources like in Philadelphia, we have wards and ward leaders. Getting connected with your very hyper-local wards and then getting involved in the state party system and then going county by county. It's a big state. Mm-hmm. So I think that here in Pennsylvania, those resources around your state party are important. I don't know, I'm not going to ask you your political affiliation, but I know that on the Republican side, there's a group called the Anstein Series for Excellence, and they promote... they do a training program for Republican women that are trying to do what you're doing. So mm-hmm. I don't know if there are similar resources on the Democratic side. But yeah?
There is. It's called
CURD. It's a national
organization.
I am. Okay. Great. But so those resources are out there, for you to connect to them. Because, ladies, I have to tell you that in looking at some of the research around the state, we had over 1.1 million registered women. These are people that are already registered to vote. We didn't have to register them, that didn't show up on election day. The margin of victory was not that much in Pennsylvania. That matters. So, there are people out there that are, that are willing to support you, but it's connecting to them, I think, both through the parties and through Emerge and Anstein, depending what side of the aisle you're on, that will help you find the resources to run. Because the fact of the matter is, the money still plays a very important role in your ability to get elected.
Now, can you tell me your statistics on women that cross party lines? How often do they vote on their personal issues versus...
I'm really sorry. I just want to respect the other panelists. So can we? We've only got time for one more question, and then we're going to close out. So I'll just feel free. Go ahead.
Thank you. This is addressed to Allison. Allison, I just want to take you up on that offer that you made to ask for a favor, and that's what I'm doing now. And I heard that you have a lot of influence as being the advisor to the president. My daughter, she's 9 years old, and she was really, really excited when she found out that I was going to hear Michelle speak. She was very disappointed that she couldn't come, so she wrote a letter. So I'm going to use my voice to ask you as a favor to see if you can deliver this to Michelle, because she's using her voice in this letter to stop bullying in schools.
Good for her. Thank you.
All right. Are you giving me the letter? All right, good luck. Allison, if you want to grab the letter. So before we close, because I know some of you are leaving, I just thought it would be particularly helpful if we left and closed the session with each of our panelists just giving you one or two things that are practical and meaningful in terms of developing your political acumen and helping you at work to manage your social environment. So just one or two things that you would like the audience to take away.
So my advice is that don't think of political acumen as extracurricular. Make it 20% of your to-do list. Work on something every day. In the morning when you're putting together your to-do list, find things, what can I do? What's the one thing I can do today to increase my influence? What's the one contact, one network I want to build today? And what's the one little action I can take towards that? What's one crucial conversation I need to be having today? And every day consciously work on it as if it's a performance metric that no one else will see, but eventually will help you win.
Very good advice. Allison?
Action is a perfect segue. I would say do two things, three things if you take action. One is listen, Be that person that listens and hears when people talk to you. Don't just, for those of you that are parents, you know, when they tell us that like that it takes us 0.4 seconds to respond to a question your child asks you. Are you being thoughtful about that response if it's 0.4 seconds, right? So listen and make sure you've heard what people are telling you and asking you for. And the second I would say is ask. We hear so much research about how women don't ask. It doesn't have to be for a $25,000 raise. Ask for the small things, for favors that people can deliver for you that help you do that back and forth relationship and currency building. But whatever you do, Anna's right, take action. Do it. You've heard a lot about inspiration and empowerment. We're trying to build a movement. Let's be a movement of action and women that do.
Mm-hmm. Very good. And lastly, I just want to share with you guys, just remember, you're not broken. You don't need to be fixed. You have the skills you need. I think the taking action piece is really just starting to use those skills and understanding sort of what the political environment is, how it's used, and how you can use it to your advantage. So that's our message for today. So thank you very much.